Ms. Edward?
Yes. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Carol Edward, and I am here today to represent Mr. Jose Chuck and his wife, and they are also present in court. And I appreciate receiving the court's request to address the Munoz case. And I know that the court's familiar with the basic facts in this case. We have a 245I issue, which is the provision that provides for people to adjust status in the United States if they enter illegally. And it was extended and provided that if a person was physically present on the day that the law was enacted, that they could then make this application to adjust status if they otherwise qualified and filed the required petition before the April 30th, 2001 deadline. With that, there's some major, the major issues involved in this case really have to do with congressional intent. And the difference between 203A and the 245I really have to, they come back to the congressional intent. And I think you can also see how that applies in when you look at the 203C analysis that was done in the Albino case. Because in this case, it was in the 203 NACARA case, what happened was there was a lot of old lawsuits that had been out there. The ABC litigation, I'm sure this court is well familiar with the number of lawsuits that have been pending since the 80s. There was a number of asylum cases that people had been permitted to be here in the United States, and there was a huge backlog of asylum cases that hadn't been adjudicated. I believe there was hundreds of thousands of asylum cases that had just been sitting. I mean, I personally had a number of those cases from the early 1990s that never got interviewed until the 2000s. So there was a number of people who had been legally here in the United States, permitted under color of law to be here, and the Congress decided that they were going to provide them a benefit in efforts to clean up a number of these cases and to afford these people a benefit to stay in the United States. So they did the NACARA, and they addressed it to specific people. And they said, we are willing to cover these people who were here on these ABC litigation. We're here to cover these people who did this TPS application prior to an earlier date. We're here to allow people who are from former Eastern Bloc countries who may now have entirely different circumstances but were permitted to be here on asylum cases who had entered before December of 1990 to file these applications and to go through this process. So there was a specific class created, and it was defined by prior action. And it was the congressional intent was to clean up and provide an opportunity for these people. With 245I, what they did was they said there is a number of people, again, who are married to U.S. citizens or who are some way eligible for a benefit through an I-130 or, in some case, employment cases. And we want to allow these people to process their applications in the United States. We don't want to force them to have to leave, especially given the issues that develop when people have to go back and consular process. And with a lot of these people who have entered illegally that 245I cured, they would be subject to unlawful presence bars, have extreme hardship they have to establish. It could take months and months and literally years to get some of these people.
Counsel, was the 245I at issue in this case, was that an extension of a prior deadline?
It was.
Now, what was the prior deadline? So 1997, 1998?
January 14, 1998 was the prior deadline.
I suppose Congress could have approached this in one of two ways. One would have been to provide that a timely filing would be 1 year from or 2 years from a fixed date, which is typically the way a statute of limitations is written, or they could have provided, as they did here, a fixed date by which the application had to be filed. And normally, those are construed to be statutes of repose when there's a firm deadline. Why shouldn't we look at it that way?
Well, the reason, and that's obviously the major issue in this case. The problem is that with, if you look at that differentiation, it's not clear cut across the board, because even the LAMP case that they refer to was one in which it said, you know, they found that it was a statute of repose, and they said that you have 1 year to discover this this fraud, and then if – but it has to be filed within 3 years of a specific offering. They had a date, and it was set forth similar to what you're describing we might describe as a statute of limitations. In that case, they said it was a statute of repose.
Which seems to be sort of an a fortiori argument that when Congress gives us a hard date, that it has to be a statute of repose. I mean, your analysis of LAMP would tend to call into question our decision in Alvillo, but it doesn't call into question our decision in Munoz.
A lot of it has to do with, again, it's the congressional intent in doing this. When Congress passed this law, and if you look at the...
How can we measure the intent other than by the fact that Congress said, if you get your application in by January 30th, we will consider it?
Well, the only thing that we have to look at beyond what the law specifically says is the congressional record. We have Kennedy's comments, and we have the joint memorandum that was issued, and which was attached to my brief. And in this joint memorandum, it says that they want to encourage all potentially eligible people to apply. They want that, they ask that INS have regulations that encourage skeletal applications. They state that they want them to get out there and do a broad outreach program. So
none of that was put into the law.
That's true. It's not part of the law, but
these look like suggestions.
But in the Alvillo case, it's the same thing. That there is no specific.
The Attorney General was given some discretion there and was allowed to set a deadline.
That's true.
And that's quite different from this one, where Congress itself set the date.
It's true on the date, but they also talk about the filing, and they talk about being liberal in an interpretation and what is an appropriate filing in this case.
Well, that might give you some range in looking at what paper is complete or incomplete if it's filed before April 30th. The problem is that the paper here was not received at INS by April 30th.
True.
There's a side argument here about whether the check was there and whether everything was complete, but that seems to be irrelevant. INS didn't get it by April 30th, 2001.
And I did do a thorough search of their record, and I could find nothing that would indicate that they did, in fact, receive it by that date. So I have to agree. I mean, I would love to be able to argue that they got it, but I can't because there is absolutely no evidence of that. But the issue, again, and I realize that's what it's all about, but that is the main point on any statute of limitations, whether you call it a statute of repose or not. Should there be equitable considerations applied to this?
But we have held that if it's a statute of repose, that we do not have equitable tolling. And if it's a statute of limitations, then generally we do have the power to grant equitable tolling. So the way that we categorize this turns out to be really important. It's the difference between Alvillo and Munoz.
Mm-hmm.
And this case looks a whole lot more like Munoz than it does like Alvillo.
It has a set date, but again, it's the congressional intent that's involved, because if you look at other statutes of repose or you look at other statutes of limitations, there is some flexibility. They don't all just say this is it, and we are looking at a whole different area of law. This is immigration. We're not looking at a civil lawsuit where the government...
It's really hard for this panel, because we're not capable of overruling ourselves in Munoz. And we have this decision in Munoz on NACARA that says when Congress sets a fixed deadline, it is a statute of repose and no equitable tolling is available. Now, do you have a mechanism by which this panel can distinguish Munoz?
Well, again, the only way to distinguish Munoz, I believe, is to look at the congressional intent involved.
Should be to look at Senator Kennedy's comments and this joint memorandum that was put into the congressional record.
Yes. To look at it to see what was the purpose of the extension of this and what did they intend. Because the only differentiation between, if you want to, there is a deadline. I mean, there was a deadline of April 30th, 2001. There's no question about it. I can't contest that. It doesn't say, or if it was submitted some other way, or if the attorney screwed up, then we can allow some other way to obtain this. There's no.
You want to save a little time for rebuttal?
Yes.
Okay. We'll give you a minute. We'll hear from the Attorney General at this time. Mr. Holyoak?
May it please the Court, my name is Dallin Riley Holyoak, trial attorney with the United States Department of Justice, and I represent the Attorney General respondent in this matter. I would like to begin by directly addressing the concerns of the panel raised during Petitioner's argument and explain why 245I, like NACARA 203A, is a statute of repose. First of all, as Petitioner stated, the main crux of this whole issue is legislative intent. Petitioner provided no basis to distinguish Munoz from this case. Therefore, this panel could not decide contrary to Munoz and find that the statute 245I here is a statute of limitations and not a statute of repose.
Can the petitioner file for relief from Mexico?
Yes, that's right. Because the petitioner...
I have a follow-up. Is there a time bar or anything like that that would apply?
Yes, because petitioner has been present in the United States illegally for an extended amount of time, he would have to go to Mexico, consular process, and he would have to file a waiver. The waiver is DHS Form 601-601. And at this time, there's no way we could represent how long that would take. Petitioner states possibly it could take 18 months. It could take longer.
Okay.
But there's not a regulatory or statutory one-year, five-year, that kind of thing. It has to do with how many of these are available and how long the line is.
That's correct.
But in terms of once that visa is obtained, then he is eligible for the relief he sought by virtue of his marriage, and I take it now his children.
Right. He would have to consular process with a packet for, he wouldn't be able to adjust. He would have to come over from Mexico with a visa. And he's already had his I-130 approved, so he's had the permission to apply for that visa, to apply for entry back into the United States, but he would have to file a 601, DHS 601.
Counsel, the INS started to process this application as though it had been filed before April 30th.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The doctrine of estoppel or equitable tolling is one that can be court imposed. Does the INS or DHS, who've got this now, have the discretion to admit Mr. Balanchuk, notwithstanding the lateness of his application? Is it within their discretion? Is it sort of a matter of prosecutorial deference or discretion?
That's an excellent question, and I can't answer it for this panel. That decision would have to be left to DHS, and I wouldn't be able to state whether or not they would be able to go ahead and process the adjustment. They've already given...
Judge Bybee's not asking you whether they should or not. He's asking you whether the Attorney General has that discretion, and you don't know the answer to that?
I don't, because the board didn't speak to it in its decision, and I can only support what the board said.
A general proposition and a general question, and a pretty important one,
right.
And you don't know the answer.
Well, I can say that from the statute, 245I provides that you have to meet two requisites. You have to meet the date, and your application has to be approvable when filed. DHS and INS, when they processed all these applications, it's always a bifurcated process. They always go through the I-130, which is the initial request, a petition which is filed by somebody, in this example, Mr. Balanchuk's wife. They go ahead and they approve those. Many of these were approved. Many of these were approved which were filed after the date because the I-130 is not linked directly to the adjustment. The adjustment's in I-485. And the I-485 is then processed either by DHS, if it's done through consular processing or some other method, or by EOIR, which is the immigration judges and the board. In this case, the second step couldn't go through because in the statute with 245I, they have to have met the deadline. So DHS, when it processed the adjustment, he ended up in removal proceedings. And then as he went through removal proceedings with EOIR, the board later said, we're not sure if we have jurisdiction because we haven't addressed this issue before. This is a brand new issue not only for this panel but also for the agency because the agency hasn't previously been presented whether or not it has jurisdiction to adjust somebody underneath 245I when they didn't meet the deadline. They do generally have adjustment power.
Okay, so I'll follow up to Judge Hawkins because I want to make sure I'm very clear on this.
Right.
If there were a power of let's say, sort of non-prosecution, okay, sort of one in which the agency would stay its hand, the agency that would have the power to do that would be DHS and not the Department of Justice, which would include BIA.
Right.
So the BIA doesn't have any power here. That power would with Mr. Chertoff, not with Mr. Mukasey. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So that's part of the problem here is that once,
right,
after 911,
we separated INS from the Department of Justice and transferred over to DHS, you've got another agency involved here.
That's right. And at that point also, there's more than just this case. There are probably thousands upon hundreds of thousands of cases out there where people either missed the deadline, their attorneys messed up, something happened, so that they ended up in this glut of cases that happened afterwards. And this brings it all back to the main issue, which is congressional intent. Congress understood when it passed 245I that people would be left out. There's no doubt about that. We made that clear in our brief, that they knew people would be left out, and not only just because of the filing date. As they stated, they were worried about scam artists. All of these issues were presented to Congress. Congress, regardless, set the date. There were questions after this date expired. I remember from when I was initially practicing that there was questions about whether or not they would again pass another 245I. It never happened. There are other cases that were compelling. It still never happened. So what we're presented with in this case is a general immigration issue that's a policy issue that's best left to the legislature. It wraps it all back up into the fact that 245I was set with a fixed deadline for political and other reasons, which we don't have the power to look at this point. The board could only look at 245I, what it said in the statute, and the statute said it had to be filed by April 30th, 2001. The application of the petition was not filed by April 30th, 2001.
What is or would be the process whereby a person in petitioner circumstance could ask DHS for relief in this case?
Well, the correct process and the correct remedy is to consular process. If he can't consular process, he would have to ask the district director for a deferral of removal. That's always up to the district director of DHS, and can happen in a number. I mean, that's up to their discretion completely.
I can ask Ms. Edwards this. Do you know whether they've complied with the Lozada ruling in terms of protesting their attorney's actions here? Yeah. Ms. Edwards, do you know the answer to that question?
I'm sorry.
Have you complied with Lozada?
Yes.
You filed a complaint with the State Bar?
Yes. And it was included in the record.
Okay.
All right. We would dispute that because in the record, which is all we have before this court, there is no evidence that bar complaint was actually filed. We do have concerns whether or not that was crafted just for immigration or just for litigation purposes, because it is actually fairly common to file a form that has never been submitted to, and there's no proof of mailing, there's no proof that the bar received it.
Would that affect anything in your view if they made a Lozada filing?
As far as this case, the board stops at its analysis on whether or not the statute was one of repose. It didn't move on to the next step, which
so
is whether or not there's
no.
Equitable. So the answer is no, and if that was the issue that this court decided to hold, then it would have to be remanded to the board. If the court decides it's statute of limitations, then it would have to remand to the board to then consider the next step, which is there an equitable
ruling? Well, Lozada really would only go to the question of whether it should be equitably tolled, assuming that equitable tolling was available.
Correct.
Your argument is equitable tolling isn't available, so the whole Lozada ruling is
right.
Or compliance with Lozada is irrelevant.
That's absolutely correct. That's absolutely correct.
Do you have any? Is there any evidence that you're aware of that the petitioner has any kind of criminal history?
No, there's not, Your Honor.
As far as you know, it's a clean record?
That's as far as we know. It's based on the record.
Okay. I think we understand your argument.
All right. With the court's permission, may I conclude?
Sure.
Okay. The agency properly found Mr. Balanchuk's claim to be entirely without merit.
You're going to read this to us?
Yeah. If that's...
Why don't you just stop right there? We understand you want us to deny relief and the reasons for it, and we'll hear a rebuttal argument at this time.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming in this morning.
Thank you.
Ms. Edward?
Briefly, the distinguishment between Munoz, there is a second one, and I do want to mention that again. One is the congressional intent, and the second one is the way the class was defined. In Munoz and Nacara, the class was specifically defined to include people that involved past behavior. In 245I, it was involved a future deadline, which is somewhat different than the normal procedure, or at least it's a little bit different than the provision contained in that Munoz was interpreting in Nacara. It's another distinguishment for this court. I realize it's difficult to make these, but I do believe that they are different cases. They involve different congressional intent and different, entirely different purposes. And that is why the Munoz decision was appropriate and the other one was not.
Have you asked on behalf of your client of the district director of DHS for deferral of removal?
We have not.
the intent to?
You can't ask for it until every appeal has been exhausted.
Well, that was my next question. Do you intend to?
Well, we are considering our options at this point. It's possible, but it's unlikely to be granted because it's only in cases where someone has severe health issues that if they are removed, their life is threatened, that those are typically granted. So it's very, very unusual. So his next option would probably be to consular process, and it involves a separation between him, his wife, and kid for, you know, a long time, probably a year and a half. Or if we don't get a waiver, it would be 10 years because that's what the bar is. It's a 10-year bar.
Okay. Thank you for your argument. Thank both sides for their argument. The case just argued will be submitted for decision. We'll proceed to the last case on the argument calendar this morning, which is Lewis against the